From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. Greg Bernstein will leave the job of Baltimore City State's attorney in 2 weeks. This morning, he's in our studio. We'll talk with him about his time as the city's top prosecutor and get his thoughts on grand jury decisions in Ferguson and New York. Then, a black man from Maryland has spent decades befriending members of the Ku Klux Klan and in the process motivating some of them to leave it. He joins us to tell us why.
All I want to know was, how can you hate me when you don't even know me?
Plus, poet Sue Ellen Thompson explores her relationships with her parents and with her transgender child in her latest work, a collection called They. She talks about it with Tom Hall. First, the news.
I'm Nathan Sterner, and if you were listening to Maryland Morning Live, I'd be bringing you the latest Maryland news right about now. You can catch the live show Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 9 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 FM in Ocean City, and online at WIPR.org. For now, you're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast. Thanks for downloading us. Let's get the show underway.
Thanks, Nathan. This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. The 8 days of Hanukkah began at sundown yesterday. We wish everyone celebrating a very happy Hanukkah. In 2 weeks, Greg Bernstein will leave his post as Baltimore City State's attorney. During his 4-year tenure, he's reorganized prosecutors into geographic units and targeted violent criminals. But perhaps the decisions that have captured the most attention are the things he decided not to do, namely charge police officers in the deaths of Tyrone West and Anthony Anderson, both unarmed black men who died in police custody. Marilyn Mosby was elected to replace Bernstein. He announced this week that in February he'll rejoin the law firm where he worked before becoming state's attorney, Zuckerman Spader. But first, right now, Greg Bernstein joins me in the studio to talk about his time in office. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Sheila. Always great to be here.
So first, I want to get your perspective on the grand jury decisions in Ferguson and Staten Island. Is our grand jury system broken?
Absolutely not. But what I would say is that cases in which individuals die while in police custody are very unique, and that it's interesting that you hear the old adage that a prosecutor can indict a ham sandwich, mm-hmm. meaning suggesting that a prosecutor can, you know, get the grand jury to follow his will, so to speak. And I think the opposite is true. And so I think in some respects we've seen that maybe perhaps in the Ferguson case, where the prosecutor has a preconceived idea or view about what he or she thinks the evidence shows and where the case should go, and presents it or in such a way to achieve that result. Prosecutors, you'll do that every day across the country. And so I think that perhaps what happened here is reflective of that to some extent, which I think causes us maybe to think hard about how we investigate these cases, not necessarily whether the grand jury system itself is broken, because that I do not believe.
Well, one can interpret the ham sandwich line to mean that the prosecutor has enormous power to make an indictment happen or not happen. And in these cases, critics have said, clearly the prosecutor did not want an indictment, and an indictment was not returned.
Well, right. I mean, critics have said that. And my point is simply that these are difficult cases. They involve very sophisticated legal principles and concepts involving whether police officers use excessive force or not. And you have to couple that or juxtapose that with the emotion and the public reaction in these cases and a perception that the prosecutors who are working with these police officers on a daily basis are just too close to them to be completely objective. And so what I have suggested, what I have written about...
You wrote an op-ed in the Sun this month.
Yeah, I did. And my suggestion is that we think about, in cases in which civilians die while in police custody or tragically are shot, that perhaps we think about appointing a special counsel, an individual, a former prosecutor that has prosecutorial experience, that has investigatory experience, to conduct the investigation. And I think what that does, which I think is really important, is it gives the public a sense that justice was served and the rule of law prevailed.
Who would appoint such a special prosecutor?
Well, those are kind of the devil in the details, if you will. I mean, there's a range of ways that that could happen. For instance, in the federal system, when the Attorney General of the United States feels that the Department of Justice has some actual or perceived conflict, he or she makes the determination about who to appoint. So you could have that. You could have some other elected official or body. I mean, those are things that one would need to talk about.
Is there any state that does that?
None that I am aware of, but it does not mean that the other states do not have the authority or the power to do it. I just don't know.
But the system you're proposing doesn't exist at the state level anywhere, as far as you know.
No. What we do in Maryland is that when in our office, if we have a conflict, for example, if one of my assistants is the victim of a crime, or one of my assistant or one of my support personnel is a witness, key witness to a particular offense, so that there's no potential conflict, we sometimes will call upon our colleagues in other counties, Baltimore County, Montgomery County, Southern Maryland, whomever, to step in and do that case. That's another option. You could do that. There's no, we do not need any statutory authority to make that request. We've done that in a number of cases in the last 4 years. I'm not so sure that would be the right way to do it in this particular case to achieve, you know, the kind of I'm searching for the word, but the so that the public understands that it is a full and fair investigation.
In retrospect, could you have done that? Could you have brought in someone else to be the decider in either the Tyrone West or Anthony Anderson cases?
Well, I believe that as the elected official, it is my responsibility to fully and fairly investigate those cases. I think that, you know, just parking a dump truck of evidence into the grand jury and letting them decide is really abdicating that responsibility. That's what I was alluding to before, where I think that prosecutors in those kinds of cases sometimes use the grand jury as a way to get political cover so that they can then say, well, the grand jury made the decision, not me. But for all the reasons we talked about a few minutes ago, that may not be the most, you know, transparent way to go about doing it. I just think that this is what you were elected to do. And that's why in the cases that you alluded to before, I personally handled the investigations, working with senior prosecutors in my office, because I wanted to make sure that when I stood before the cameras with whatever the decision was going to be, that I was comfortable with it.
But as you know much better than I, there was among some people the perception, you used the word perception a few minutes ago, that you have to work all the time with police officers, you're perhaps too close to make an independent judgment. I mean, looking in retrospect, is there anything you do differently in the Tyrone West and Anthony Anderson decisions, either how you reached them or how you communicated them?
Right. No, I mean, I feel very confident and comfortable with the decision that we made. I think that it was clearly supported by the evidence. The investigation was thorough. There is literally no doubt in my mind that the right decision was made. These are very complicated cases, as I alluded to before, and that's why maybe we need to think about in the future in certain instances where cases generate the kind of reaction that the one in Ferguson did, the one in Staten Island, that you maybe think about appointing a special counsel.
That's Baltimore City State's Attorney Greg Bernstein here on WIPR Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about his time as the city's top prosecutor. Do you think that those decisions we've been talking about played a role in your loss in the Democratic primary?
I think that the road is paved with fools who spend time trying to, you know, figure out why they won or lost particular elections. I don't speculate on that stuff, Sheila.
What do you think will be your most lasting contribution as state's attorney?
Well, you know, I think that as a public official, you know, when you sign up for something like this, whatever the position might be, I think that your goal should be to leave the agency in a better place than you found it. And I think that if that's the measure, if you will, of whether you're successful or not, I think that in some small way we were successful. I think we leave it a much better place. I think the office is much more efficient, more effective. It's more focused. The people in my office, the prosecutors and the support staff, work extremely, extremely hard. You know, there's a real sense of energy now and camaraderie. And I think that that's now carried over in the results that we've been able to achieve. So I think that hopefully that's the legacy that I'll leave.
As I mentioned, Marilyn Mosby, who has worked as a city prosecutor in the past, will take over as state's attorney in January. What do you think will be her biggest challenge?
Well, I don't know what will be her biggest challenge, but I do think that, you know, looking forward, some of the things that I've seen that I think are challenges are, number one, not necessarily in particular, but certainly number one is process. The way the cases are scheduled for trial in the Baltimore City Circuit Court system make it extremely difficult for us to successfully prosecute cases because we only have a few judges that hear felony cases, not nearly enough for the volume. And so what happens, Sheila, is the cases are just routinely postponed month after month after month. But the problem is that each trial date, the prosecutor has to prepare for trial. It's almost like Groundhog Day all over again. And so what happens is that each time that happens, witnesses' memories start to fade, victims' memories start to fade. Don't forget, these are individuals who don't want to come to court. They didn't sign up for this. And cases don't get better with age. They get worse. And I think the extent to which we can try to change the way the cases are scheduled, I think would go a long way to improving our ability to successfully prosecute those cases. I think another big challenge is, and will always be, the relationship between the state's attorney's office and the police department. I've worked extremely hard in the last 4 years, and frankly, I think with some real success in building that relationship, but we still have to break down this perception among a lot of detectives and officers that their role ends when the arrest is made. And conversely, we have to break down the perception that you see in a lot of my prosecutor's office that my role does not begin until the arrest is made and the case comes to me. And so what we've tried to do is marry those two concepts together and have prosecutors and detectives working together both to investigate cases and then working together to prepare them for trial. We've had great success in that, particularly in our major investigations unit, which has been enormously successful, as well as our homicide division. I think that's something we can continue to work on.
We are out of time, and that's probably an appropriate way to end this conversation. Thank you.
All right, Sheila, great to see you.
Greg Bernstein. He's Baltimore City State's attorney until the end of the month. Marilyn Mosby will be sworn in January 5th. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Marilyn Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. Ahead on Marilyn Morning, a black man reaches out to members of the Ku Klux Klan. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We're at Marilyn Morning. Now, back to the show.
This is Marilyn Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. You might be surprised to hear that a man from Maryland with a collection of Ku Klux Klan memorabilia, medallions, T-shirts, robes, hoods, is black. His name is Daryl Davis. For decades, he's arranged to meet face-to-face with Klan members and to attend Klan rallies across the country. His quest, he says, is to get them to answer one question: how can you hate me if you don't even know me? His collection of memorabilia isn't a celebration of the Klan's message, but rather tokens of accomplishment. All of the pieces are from former Klan members whom he befriended after they left the group. In 1998, Daryl Davis published a book about his experiences called Clandestine Relationships, A Black Man's Odyssey in the Ku Klux Klan. He's planning to release an updated edition in 2015. 5 weeks ago, Davis was honored by the Search for Common Ground, a nonprofit dedicated to international conflict resolution, for his effort to end violent confrontation. And Daryl Davis joins me in the studio. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Now, Daryl, you're a professional musician, and I want listeners to hear you playing at that Common Ground Award ceremony last month.
Welcome on over, baby. Whole lot of shaking going on. Come on over, baby. Baby, you can't go wrong. I ain't faking. Whole lot of shaking going on. I said, come on over, baby.
Am I right that it was that kind of boogie-woogie music that connected you with the first member of the Klan you met with?
Yes, it is. And I want to point out also that I befriended these members while they were still active in the Klan, and we became better friends after they left.
Okay. Tell me about that first meeting.
That first meeting, I was 1983. Country music had made a resurgence in this country. So, you know, if you wanted to make a living as a musician, you played country music. And I enjoyed country music, so I joined a country band. And I was the only black guy in the band, and consequently the only black guy in many of the places where we would play. So we played a place in Frederick, Maryland, called the Silver Dollar Lounge. It was an all-white bar, a truck stop bar. And when I say all-white, I don't mean that blacks could not go in there. What I mean is that blacks did not go in there, and that was by their own choice. And it was a good choice because they were not welcome. So here I was in the Silver Dollar Lounge, and I came off the bandstand on the first break after doing a set. And I was walking to a table to sit down, and a white gentleman came up behind me and put his arm around my shoulder and said, "I really enjoy your all's music." And I shook his hand and thanked him. And he says, "You know, this is the first time I ever heard a black man play the piano like Jerry Lee Lewis." And I wasn't offended, but I was kind of taken aback, like, you know, where is he coming from? Doesn't he know?
Yeah.
And innocently, not even facetiously, I said to him, "Well, where do you think Jerry Lee Lewis learned how to play?" And he says, "What are you talking about?" And I said, "Well, he learned that same style from where I learned it, from black blues and boogie-woogie piano players." "Oh, no, 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 no. Jerry Lee invented that." I said, "No, he didn't." We argued back and forth. I told the man, you know, that I know Jerry Lee personally. He's a good friend of mine. He's told me himself where he learned how to play. The guy didn't buy that I knew Jerry Lee or that he learned anything from black people, but he wanted to buy me a drink because he was fascinated that I could play this white style of music. And so I let him buy me a cranberry juice, and we got to talking. And then he made the remark, "You know, this is the first time I ever sat down and had a drink with a black man." And now I'm curious, you know, this guy's in his 40s probably. And how is it that he had never done that before? And I asked him. And at first he didn't answer me. Then eventually he told me, "I'm a member of the Ku Klux Klan." So I, you know, at that point I realized the power of music, how it can bring people from diverse ends of the spectrum together in the middle. Music brought us together, where had I come into that bar on my own, I probably would have had to fight my way out.
And at that point, did you have any idea that you would go on to have other conversations with members of the Klan?
Not immediately, but I've always been curious, how can you hate me when you don't even know me? And that started in childhood when I had rocks thrown at me while I was marching in a Cub Scout parade and by white spectators in 1968.
Where was that?
That was in Belmont, Massachusetts, right outside of Boston. You know, that was the height of the Civil Rights Movement, 1968. I was 10 years old. And I could not understand it. You know, why are they hitting me? They don't even know me. They've never seen me before, never spoken to me. And just because of the color of my skin, I'm being attacked. So how can you hate me when you don't even know me? So the Klansman, you know, this is years later, 1983, gave me his number because he was that curious about me. He wanted me to call him anytime I was to return to the Silver Dollar Lounge because he wanted to bring his friends, right, his Klan friends, Klansmen and Klanswomen, to see this black guy. I'm not sure he called me a black guy, but to see this black guy play piano like Jerry Lee Lewis. You know, that was a novelty for him. So I agreed. I called him, you know, every 6 weeks on a Wednesday or Thursday. I said, "Hey, man, you know, we're going to be down at the Silver Dollar Lounge this week, and come on out." And he would come, and he'd bring other Klan members. And they would watch me play. They would get out there on the dance floor and dance and carry on, not in their robes and hoods. You know, they came in regular clothes. And so I would meet, you know, some of them. Some of them did not want to meet me. You know, they would back off and watch me from afar. And this went on until the end of 83, when I left the band and went back to playing rock and roll and blues and other things that were going on in 1984. But when I decided to write the book, I decided, you know what, I'm going to start with that guy. I'm going to contact him and have him hook me up with the Klan leader of Maryland. I'm going to interview that guy, and then I'm going to spread out, go up north, go down south, go to the Midwest, to the West, and interview various Klan groups, because I need to get that answer as to how can you hate me when you don't even know me.
And what has been the typical answer? What kind of range in answers have you gotten?
Oh, gosh. You know, nobody can really answer the question, you know, because when you're sitting there talking with somebody one-on-one, you find that you have more in common with them than you do in contrast. And it's hard to hate somebody. You may disagree with the person, but it's hard to hate somebody who speaks the same language you do, who may even like some of the same things that you do, who's read the same books that, you know, that you have, that kind of thing. So you find those commonalities, and then, you know, they'll tell me that I'm inferior. I mean, I've heard them tell me that, you know, that black people have smaller brains than white people, and you know, we're not the chosen ones. You know, we came from Ham, or we came from Cain, and you know, all those kind of, you know, different analogies. But they end up saying, you know, I don't hate you. Whereby before they did hate me, now they tolerate me, kind of thing. But then the more you find that you have in common, the less you have in contrast, and that hate tends to diminish, and then, you know, you become friends.
That's Daryl Davis, a musician who lives in Silver Spring, here on WIPR, Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about his decades of conversations with Klan members, which he's described in his book, Clandestine Relationships, A Black Man's Odyssey in the Ku Klux Klan. Several KKK members you've spoken with have left the Klan and given you their robes.
That's right, because the hate has been shedded. No, they don't hate anymore. They begin to see the value, the humanity of the person sitting across from them. Just because that person has a different color doesn't always mean that that person is inferior to them.
And you've kept the robes.
I've kept the robes, yeah. One day I'm going to open up a museum. You know, two of the most important things that I've learned, and I continue to go to Klan rallies across the country, et cetera. But two of the most important things that I've learned is this. Number one, while you are actively learning about someone else, at the same time, you are passively teaching them about yourself. So you always want to be upfront. You always want to be honest, because you think you're gleaning all this information from this Klansman. He's also learning from you by your behavior, by your actions, et cetera. So you always want to keep everything open in the front. The second thing is this. When two enemies are talking, they're not fighting. They may be yelling and screaming. They may be disagreeing, but at least they're talking. And while they're talking, they're not fighting. It's when the talking ceases that the ground becomes fertile for violence. So you always want to keep the lines of communication open with those with whom you disagree.
Well, but I cannot imagine that every conversation you've tried to start has ended well.
No, I've had to put somebody in the hospital or put somebody in jail, you know, when I've been attacked for no reason other than the color of my skin. But fortunately, that, you know, has not been the most common occurrence. Initially, when I would meet with these people, now everybody in the Klan all across the country, they know my name if they don't know me. So they know that I'm black, you know, they've heard or whatever. But initially, I would have my secretary call them and set up the interview and not tell them that I was black. So it was a shock for them when I would show up. Sometimes they would say, okay, yeah, I'll talk to him, thinking I'm a white writer. And they would invite me over to their home. So when I'm standing on the porch knocking on the door, you know, you can imagine the reaction they got when I said, okay, I'm Daryl Davis. You know, other times, you know, we would meet at a neutral place, a restaurant or a hotel room, something like that.
And you set these interviews up saying, I'm writing a book.
Yes, which was true, you know.
What kind of reaction from the black community? I would think there must be some in the black community who...
Well, you know, just like a Klan member, you know, a black person is not stamped out of a standard cookie cutter
mm-hmm.
either.
Right.
You know, they come from all walks of life. Black people who know me, my friends, well, you know, they accept me because they already know that I'm crazy. But those who've read my book or who've seen me interviewed, or perhaps the ones who might be hearing this interview right now that you're conducting, will get a better sense and not rush to conclusion. Because, you know, that's what the Klan does. That's what bigoted people do. They jump to conclusion. You know, the word prejudice, to prejudge. All right? I've had some blacks, you know, call me an Oreo, call me an Uncle Tom. I was challenged by somebody in the NAACP one time, a leader, saying, you know, how can you do this? You know, we work hard to sit down, I mean, to get 10 steps forward, and you sit down with the enemy and have dinner, and you put us 20 steps back.
Hmm.
And then I pull out my robes and hoods and say, look, this is what I've done to put a dent in racism. How many robes and hoods have you collected? And then they shut up.
You're talking about huge transformations for Klansmen who leave in conversation with you. Big changes in their lives. How have you changed in this conversation?
Well, I've changed in that I've grown to be more patient. I've grown to have more hope. Because, you know, we as children, we hear the terms, a tiger will never change its stripes. A leopard doesn't change its spots. You know, people are what they are. They don't change. But I've seen these changes. I never got into this research to write this book and do these interviews with the intention of converting anybody. That was not my goal at all. I wasn't trying to say, hey, you know, you need to get out of the Klan because this is wrong. No, all I want to know was, how can you hate me when you don't even know me? You know, you're sitting there talking to me. I have a college degree. I've been around the world 3 times. I've been in 53 different countries on 6 continents. You know, I've been in 49 of our states. I've learned a lot. How can you hate me? And I know as much about the Klan, if not more, than you do. And so they began to see that, and they began to respect that. And slowly but surely, some of them, their hatred and their ideology begins to evaporate, and they began to see things in a new light. They did that on their own. I was the impetus for it, but I never set out to convert them. So when I saw this happening, I was shocked. When a Klan leader told me, you know, that, you know, he wanted to get out of the Klan and that he was sorry. He apologized to me for ever being in the Klan, even though he had never done anything to me. He had told me he hated me, told me he didn't like me, you know, but he apologized to me. And today he's one of my best friends. And I said, you know what, I need to continue this. I need to continue that conversation.
I really appreciate your talking to us. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Darryl Davis. He's author of the book Clandestine Relationships, A Black Man's Odyssey in the Ku Klux Klan. Last month, he received the Common Ground Award for his efforts to end violent confrontation. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. More of this interview there, too. I'm Sheila Cast. Ahead on Maryland Morning, a poet writes about her transgender child. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Go to our website to learn more about the segment you just heard, check out our audio archives, or to join in on the conversation yourself. You can also make a pledge to support local programming like Maryland Morning. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us this morning. In a new collection of poems called They, Sue Ellen Thompson reflects on her relationship with her mother, her aging father, and her transgender child, and the ways in which that child's identity animates and informs complex questions and steadfast love. A mainstay at the Breadloaf Writers Conference for many years, Sue Ellen Thompson's work has been heard on the Writer's Almanac with Garrison Keillor and featured in the syndicated column of the U.S. Poet Laureate Ted Kooser. Since 2006, she has lived in Oxford, and this morning she has crossed the bridge to talk about this powerful and provocative collection of poems. It's great to see you. How you doing, Sue Ellen?
It's nice to be here, Tom.
Delighted to have you. So let's talk about the title of the book, They. It's a pronoun that people familiar with the transgender community will recognize.
But no one else will. Actually, this has been one of the most difficult things for me as an English major, as a mother, to learn to refer to my child by a plural pronoun has been very difficult. And it was one of the most difficult decisions I faced in putting the manuscript together, because you will notice that many of the poems, certainly the ones that talk about her as a younger child, she did not come out as transgender until she was 26 years old. I still refer to her as she and my daughter. And this was a decision I made in partnership with my editor, who felt that the book was about a mother's journey. Mm-hmm. And that journey is still ongoing.
Let's have you read that poem. It's on page 68. It's interesting. It's in sort of the middle of this collection.
Yeah, it's actually closer to the two-thirds point.
Yeah.
I did not want to make this book chronological, a before and after. It's organized along emotional and thematic lines rather than chronology. They. Reading about the artist at my daughter's first solo exhibit, I noticed that she refers to herself as queer, a once derogatory word that is now back in vogue. Unversed in the linguistic proprieties, I read on, hoping to unearth some clue as to the exact nature of her gender identity view of herself, and this is what I see. Their work is characterized by the play of the familiar and the unfamiliar, made from objects they have found within a five-block radius of their apartment. Who is they? Does she have a partner I've not met, a co-creator I know nothing about? Because my experience with coming out is limited to a gay friend from college, she sets me straight. Since neither he nor she is accurate, I should refer to her as they. Whether or not I'm okay with this is irrelevant. If I want to see her more than once a year, I may as well begin by unlearning the rule of noun-pronoun agreement. In this school, I am the student, she the teacher, they.
They is the title poem from Sue Ellen Thompson's new collection called They. She's here in our studio on 88.1. It's Marilyn Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Did you consult with Thomason, your child, they, did you have a conversation about this book and about, because this is like your other book, The Golden Hours, you were in here a few years ago and we talked about that, in which you chronicled the death of your mother in mm-hmm. that one in large measure. Very personal. You mm-hmm. write very personally, and this one is certainly very personal. This one chronicles the death of your father, who mm-hmm. you know, survived your mom by several years. Did you and Thomason have a conversation about going so public with this very intimate subject?
Let's just say no is the first answer. And then when it did sort of come up after the manuscript was already together, it was not a good conversation. Thomason is someone who really does not enjoy being in the spotlight and never has. And of course, even though there is a very small reading public for poetry, it is kind of a spotlight. And if I had to get permission from the people I write about to write about them, I never would have become a poet.
Yeah.
It's not something I do.
So the same holds true for your mother, for your
mm-hmm.
father, for
my husband.
For your husband.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. I do what I have to do. This is what I do, and I be who I have to be.
For parents who are presented with this very complicated and deeply emotional issue by a child, mm-hmm. As you've thought about it, as you've written about it, as you've reflected on it, and perhaps even talked to other parents and other family members of transgender people, do you have any advice? Do you have any thoughts that you can share with them?
Well, my advice is usually get with the program, accept it, deal with it, and try to move on. There are so many worse things that one can have to deal with. But I have been through this with friends or friends of friends, acquaintances. I know how difficult it is. I mean, 8 years ago, I had never heard the word transgender or genderqueer. I did not even know what that meant. And I was not prepared for it. But once I was confronted with the reality, I just tried to move forward. I mean, you have no choice.
Sure, of course.
This is who they are.
Absolutely. Was it difficult for Thomason to come out to you? You write a poem about how you heard about it. What's your understanding of
apparently
their frame of mind?
It was difficult. I always thought she was gay, which, of course, is a totally separate issue, and was patiently waiting for her to come to me and announce that, because I thought that's what parents are supposed to do, wait for the child to come to them. And our relationship began to deteriorate to the point where I felt somebody had to say something because it was getting so difficult. And it was that provoked a long letter from her explaining what she was and the terminology and all of that. And that was 8 years ago.
This is a letter that you and your husband read at an anniversary dinner, mm-hmm. and you wrote a poem about it. It's on page 21 called Anniversary. I wonder if you could read that second part of it, the 2006 one instead of the 1979 one.
Okay. And this was the week I moved to the Eastern Shore. So I had no friends. I was brand new in Oxford, and it was November 15th is my wedding anniversary. November 15th, 2006. I meet my husband at a restaurant to celebrate. Instead, he hands me a letter in which our now grown daughter lays it all out, 4 pages, single-spaced, of things we've managed not to talk about. Each year in mid-November, I think of that restaurant. Of the meal that was not eaten, the glasses that were not raised, of that letter whose secrets would require that we begin from birth again to know our only child.
Begin from birth again. Are you close, you and Thomason, now? There was obviously a period of estrangement, but...
Yeah, I mean, we communicate. We see each other. I will see them on Sunday. But close isn't the word that springs to mind. It's still a little difficult.
But it's a work in progress, perhaps.
It's a work in progress, yeah. Exactly.
All right. Well, Sue Ellen Thomason, thank you for sharing the book and sharing your thoughts about it this morning.
Thank you, Tom.
Sue Ellen Thomason, the new collection of poems is called They. It's published by Turning Point Press. We've got a link to more information on our website and more of our conversation. Come on over to WIPR.org/Marilyn Morning.
Marilyn Morning is an original production
of your public radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Matt Purdy.
We have production help from
Connor Graham,
Payam Agagasam,
and Elizabeth Sherwood.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
On this day in Maryland history, in 1906, Baltimore native Charles Joseph Bonaparte became the 5th Marylander to serve as United States Attorney General. I'm Sheila Cast. Thanks for being with us. Back with you Friday.